You use the weapon, the being dies. The being dies. Yeah. Okay. Now, if you're walking down the street and you're looking up and you step on some ants, does that meet these requirements for killing? No. Why? You didn't intend to kill them. If you don't have the intention to kill, there is no wrongdoing, except for monks. If we hear or see that a being is going to be killed for us, then we can't accept. No. It's very far removed. When you go to the store and there's a chicken there and you want to have chicken for dinner, is it a living being? Not was it, is it? Did you have the intention to kill it? Did you have a weapon? Did you use it? Did it die? But that's not your problem. That's far enough removed. Okay, how about the person that is killing all of those little bugs on all of the on your vegetables? Can you get that far away then? Well, killing is killing. But the larger the animal is, the stronger the intention has to be. But there's a lot more little bugs that die with the vegetables than there is with that one being that is bigger, but it's not as many lives that die. And it doesn't matter. I know the justification, if you didn't buy the meat, then they wouldn't kill the ant, but it's been going on from time immemorial. It's never gonna change. Well, I can't take care of them, I can only take care of me. In this country, that's true. But when you go out and you buy some meat and you're going to fix it for me, you're fixing that with love. Means that I can eat it without any problems. If you're fixing that with hatred, I'll take one bite and say, I don't want any more, thank you. Because it'll give me a stomach ache like you can't believe. Okay? The way things are being done in this country, well, in the world right now, there's an awful lot of beings that are dying needlessly because of what they're doing with the food, what they're doing with medicines that they're coming up with. I mean, I just read a thing in a magazine that said the second leading cause of death in America is the doctor's fault. Either giving the wrong medicine or the person dies on the operating table when they shouldn't have been operated on in the first place. Second. So, what's the solution? Eat healthy as you can. Don't eat things that have pesticides when you go to the doctor, you ask them point blank, this medicine you give me, what is the side effect? Because that's how a lot of people die, is the side effect of these medicines that they're coming out with. They're coming out with a lot of them very quickly, and they haven't had enough time to test. My mother had arthritis, and she went to the doctor, and she said, I have a lot of pain. He gave her a medicine, and 3 days later, she couldn't even walk because the side effect was so bad. She lost all of her taste. She couldn't smell just from the side effects of this one drug that she didn't take that much of. But getting back to Dhamma. Okay, roughness and friendship with evil. Now, these are two things that, in order for a person to develop a personality that's rough, they have to develop a lot of unwholesome states. And rough people generally cause pain to other people. And the friendship with evil, this is just saying that that's what happens when you're rough. People that curse a lot have a tendency to be rough because their mental state dips down. They have a tendency to lash out And this is one of the reasons why you want to watch that as much as you possibly can. Gentleness and friendship with good. Now this is what the Buddha continually talked about. I noticed when I was in Malaysia, I was going and visiting people in the mental institute. And everybody said that they were people that were going out of their mind. And that's not right. They were going into their mind so much that they lost track of what was happening outside. Now, I went there because there was two families in particular that they had loved ones in there and they wanted me to help them. So what did I do? I took one man, I said, give me all your dirty clothes. And he gave them to me, and I gave them to the other man. I said, you give me all your dirty clothes. Wash each other's clothes. Start helping each other. Now, the Buddha talked continually about selfless service. Practice your generosity. This is the basis of meditation. If you don't practice generosity, when you get to heavy mental states in your meditation, you really suffer a lot. Now, when he said to practice your generosity, this doesn't mean only with material goods. It means help somebody else. Make their life easier. Make them happy. Do things and say things that will make another person smile. And do it often. Share your food. The Buddha said, if you saw the advantage of sharing your food, you would never eat alone. Now, you're in a country where there's lots of food. Why? Because in the past, you shared food. Why aren't you in Ethiopia? Why aren't you in one of these countries that has famine? Your karma is strong enough to put you in a country where there's a lot of food. Continue that tradition. Give food as much as you can. Now, there's a way of giving. The Buddha said it's real important to give in this way. When you're preparing your gift, prepare it with a happy mind. While you're giving your gift, give it with a happy mind. After you've given the gift, and you reflect on what you've done, reflect with a happy mind. Now, one of my students is incredibly generous, always giving. Every time I get around her, she's giving something to somebody. And her meditation is quite good. And she said, you know, when my meditation gets bad, my mind naturally starts remembering the times that I gave something to somebody else, and I feel happy. I have joy coming up. That's how important giving is. Because it can affect the way you see the world around you, and it can affect your own mind. Help it become uplifted. Yeah. I was on goodness and gentleness and friendship with good. These. Yeah, and 4 and 5 pair, and 2 and 3 pair, but 1 does not. Not really. It kind of changes around after a while. Yeah. Yeah. Hmm? What are you talking about? The gentleness and friendship with good? That's why I started talking about generosity, because that's what gentleness and friendship with good, that's one of the better examples of it. No, they go together. Roughness and friendship with evil, No. Equal. They go together. And gentleness and friendship with good. You don't see gentle people doing things bad very often. Not that I can think of. Okay? But monks are a little bit different. They're not like laymen. Our job is to preserve Dhamma. Our job is not to work. It's not to go and pick somebody up at the airport. That's not our job. Our job is to tell people and be an example for people. And when I go out and I see someone, I see a little baby that's crying, and I cheer that baby up, what am I doing? and I'm doing it according to Dhamma. Now, the more pure my mind is, the more uplifted my mind is, just my going and seeing someone else, their mind can come up to my level. Okay? And that is being a good friend. I don't spend time working in mundane ways. I spend time purifying myself. The more pure I become, the more uplifting I can be for other people around me. Well, I've been to monasteries like that where I had to work at least 8 hours a day, but we still had to practice 4 hours. And I didn't go there to do that. So what did I do? Yes. Yeah, I go to someplace else where I can study and practice. What they had me doing was building, and I was a builder before I was a monk. That, the Buddha said, I shouldn't be doing. You shouldn't become a monk and start doing the same kind of job that you did when you weren't a monk, because those other mental states will start coming up. It's not necessary. It's not. If they don't purify their own mind, it is necessary. I don't go to the store. I don't drive anybody around. But why do they do that? Because the monks are pure and they want to support. Then they're not doing something right. If there's no supporter, they're not purifying their mind in the right way. Listen, that's an excuse. I've lived in the mountains. I've lived a long ways in the mountains. I never had any trouble getting food. Never. As a matter of fact, any time people would come and bring food, they'd bring enough for 5 or 6 people. And I'd be there by myself. I've lived in a cave up in the mountains. People knew where I was. They had to walk 3 miles to get in. They couldn't drive right up to the cave. And they got me food every day. If they didn't, I would come down. And I would walk around the village, 4 or 5 miles, 6 miles, whatever. They don't follow the system. They started not practicing alms round. And when you don't practice alms round, you lose touch with the people. And the people's mental state goes down because they're not seeing the monks. And then they don't want to support. And then the monks have to start growing their own food and all of this. Yeah. Yeah, but it all comes from not following the tradition the way it really is. And it's painful to go out on alms round if it's really cold, or it's raining, or it's sleeting, or it's snowing. It's not an easy thing. But we do it anyway. We bundle up and do it. Because it's necessary. See, in Thailand, the people, they love to see the monks. And when they see the monks, their mind becomes uplifted. Okay? And then they say, oh, I really like this monk. I want to give him something. So they give food. And if that monk doesn't come around the next day, they say, well, what's the matter? And they start getting depressed. So the monks have to go around every day. When I was in Burma, I would go out on alms round. And if I didn't go all the way to the end of the village to this one hut, boy, I heard about it. They were real upset. Why didn't you come get food from me today? They'd come to the monastery where I was and complain. And I was literally getting enough food for 4 other monks. I didn't want to carry that much food around. That's heavy. I had to walk 5 miles. 5 miles one way. So you're walking 5 miles back and you have 6 or 7 pounds worth of food. You don't want to go to this last place and get another pound. But I had to. Because that would upset them. I didn't want them upset. I wanted them to be happy. Now when I walk on alms round, my job is to send loving and kind thoughts to everyone that I see. That's my job. That's right livelihood. But staying someplace and I have to clean this. I have to go pick this person up. I have to shop and cook and do all. That's not right livelihood. Right. And that's why they have to continue on, because they're not going out on the alms round. They're not practicing the way the Buddha taught. In this country, all of the people, all of the Asians, the Asian monks that have come to this country, they buy a little place and they have their own monastery and they stay inside. And only the Asians support them. And when Americans come and they say, well, teach me some Dhamma, they don't even understand, they don't know any English. So the Americans are looking at the monks and they're going, what's the matter with this? You know, I don't want rites and rituals. I don't want to come in with a bunch of Asians and have to bow like they do. I don't understand what that's all about. What they're looking for is somebody that's really following what the Buddha taught. Now, whenever I finally get a place, my first priority is going out on alms round. And I'm not begging for food. It's not begging. I'm walking around, I'm doing my practice of sending loving and kind thoughts to everybody, wishing them well. And if they want to put food in my bowl, that's fine. Yeah. I haven't gone out here. I didn't bring my bowl. I should have, but I didn't. I went out on alms round a lot in California, and I never came back without food. And sometimes it was so much food, I had to have somebody come along so they'd help me carry it. They'd give me these cans that were this big of soup. You know, that's enough for five people, for crying out loud. And they'd give me four of those cans. That's heavy. And there were some people that they would ask me, please make sure you come by my house every day. And if they weren't there, they would leave a little bit of food out in a container. But it's really a necessary thing to have this contact. When people start finding out that the monk is really a harmless being that only wishes well, then Buddhism will start to become accepted. Until then, it's going to be pretty much like it is right now. And that's difficult. What really needs to happen is we need to have more American monks, that we're not caught up in the rites and rituals of this country or that country, and we start making our own that everybody will understand. Like, even when you go to the Thai temple, you go to the Burmese temple, you go to the Sri Lankan temple, they will sit down and they'll start repeating the five precepts, and they want everybody to do it out loud. And the monk will say this, but he says it in Pali. The Americans come and they go, what's this? I don't understand any of this. I'm not going to say something if I don't understand what it means. So what do I do when I'm talking to people and teaching them meditation and I start talking about the precepts? I say, it's a good idea if you take the five precepts every day, not as some kind of rite or ritual, but as a reminder to keep that in your mind for the rest of the day. And then if you break a precept, forgive yourself, take the precepts again right there with the determination not to break the precepts. Now, somebody in Malaysia, they became convinced that it was a real good thing to keep the precepts. I'll take the five precepts and keep them. How long do I have to do that? Well, I said, we can start out at 100 years and go on from there. It's real important. It can't be understated how important it is. Because if you want to learn about meditation, you have to have this groundwork. The groundwork of practicing your generosity and the groundwork of keeping your precepts as closely as you possibly can. When the Buddha talked about, and I think it's back in the threes, he talks about meditation. And he says there's three parts of meditation. Dana, sila, bhavana. Dana is giving, sila is morality, keeping your precepts, and then mental development. But it's all a form of mental development. Now that we've strayed a fair amount off of this one, let's get back to it here. Skill in knowing offenses and the procedure for rehabilitating from them. Now, that's something that I've been talking about quite a bit, so I don't think we have to do any more with that. Now, the next one is skill in entering and returning from jhana. Jhana is mental development. Now, I understand that a lot of people that have practiced Vipassana meditation in this country have learned it through the Burmese system. I know the Burmese system very well. I practiced it for 20 years. And for 20 years I was told that if you ever experience joy, get rid of it, don't be attached. One of the factors of jhana is joy. This is a jhana is called a pleasant abiding here and now. Joy is one of the enlightenment factors. You have to have joy. How do you not be attached to joy? Just like you're not attached to pain. You see it, you let it be, you relax, and you come back to your object of meditation. Then you won't be attached. But that doesn't mean that you're supposed to push it away. Every feeling that arises, it's all right for that feeling to be there. It has to be, because the truth is, it's there. It's got to be okay. What do you do with that in the present moment dictates what happens in the future. If you try to hold on to that joy and become attached to it, oh, this feels great, gone. It disappears. You can't be attached to joy. It's too high a mental state. One of the Brahma Viharas. Now, these are called the four immeasurables. You have loving kindness. The next highest one is compassion. The next highest one is joy. And the highest is equanimity. So don't be attached to joy. Okay, don't be attached to it. That's fine. Don't push it away. It is a wholesome mental state. There's nothing wrong with it at all. And too many times I've heard the Burmese scare people away from it. Now, there's one kind of joy that's called uplifting joy, where your body becomes incredibly light, and your mind is incredibly light, and your body can actually float off the ground a little bit. And then you go back down. It's just going up and down like that. And a monk came to me and he said, I had this experience. I was floating up off the ground and I had this joy and it was really amazing. And then I remembered I'm not supposed to be attached. And I became afraid that I would be attached and I pushed it away. What am I supposed to do now? I said, stop pushing. There's nothing wrong with joy. Joy is an important part of the spiritual path. Every time you let go of an attachment, you have relief and you feel happy, really happy, joy. So joy is the result of letting go of an attachment in the lower stages of jhana. Now, when this is talking about the skill in entering and returning from jhana, that means once you've developed being able to go into a jhana, you can make a determination before you go in, I'm going to sit in this jhana for 3 hours and 15 minutes or whatever. And then at 3 hours and 15 minutes, you'll come out exactly on that time. Now, the way I teach is mastery. I teach you how to master the jhanas. And I don't teach that until you've already been able to get up to the fourth jhana and get to the equanimity. And then we can start working with the Brahma Viharas. When you have the Brahma Viharas very well, then I'll start talking to you about timing, the length of time you're in a jhana. And you have to be right to the second. So you make a determination, I'm going to be in this jhana for 12 minutes and 33 seconds. And if you miss, then you have to make another determination to do that, and not the same time. But until you can hit it right on, you don't have any skill at going in and coming back out. And then you start lengthening the amount of time. Exactly. You see the clock just to the second. I'm not kidding. And I have students that do that. it's not impossible. Just as the clock goes to 33, you open your eyes and you're out. Well, I'm talking about advanced. Is there a specific way of meditating? Definitely. And I'll tell you more as we go on with this. But being able to go in and out of jhana, first you start lengthening the time that you're able to do that, and then you start shortening it so that you can go in and out of the jhana in between words that you're saying to somebody else. That's when you're good. And I have one student that can do that. The meditation is to learn how to silently observe and relax. Okay, so you have a thought come in, and it's not a very wholesome thought. You wish that guy a broken neck or whatever. But as soon as you see that, then you let it go and you relax. And then you come back to your object of meditation. Now, when you relax that tightness, especially the tightness in your head, you're letting go of the subtle ego belief. Okay? So this is real important. As soon as you let go of all that tension, your mind is incredibly clear, very alert, and you're bringing that mind back to your object of meditation. No thoughts in it. It takes practice, doesn't it? Yeah, and the higher you get, the more interesting things get. It really gets to be fun. You can't believe. Okay. Now, the skill in knowing the 18 elements and in paying attention to them, what that's talking about is you have a good working eye. It hits color and form, and that's called contact. That's three. You have a good working ear. It hits a sound. That's contact. That's three. You have six sense doors. Okay? You have eyes and ears, nose and tongue, body and mind. Any time one of these sense doors hits an object, that consciousness arises. Now that's what it's talking about with the 18 elements. And being able to recognize that. Now, you don't really recognize these things too much in your daily life. When you're sitting in meditation, you can see these things very, very clearly. You can see how the contact arises, how this consciousness comes up. Okay, the next one is going to explain a lot. So, let's go on to the next one, because this is talking about dependent origination. Skill in knowing the 12 sense spheres and dependent origination. The 12 sense spheres are the eye and the color and form. That's the sense sphere. Okay, so you have 12 of those because you have six sense doors and you have an external object in that. Okay? Now, the dependent origination is kind of an interesting thing. This is a cause and effect of how everything arises in the mind and body process. How everything works. And this is such a subtle thing that it took a Buddha to see it and to explain it so that we could have some kind of an idea of how it works. Eventually, you will be able to see it, depending on how much you meditate, how serious you are in doing it, your progress, how much you're willing to let go of
old ways of doing things and start seeing cause and effect relationships. Now, the 12 steps of dependent origination. Because of ignorance, sankhara. Sankhara is one of those big words. When you talk about Dhamma, Dhamma has a lot of different meanings. Dhamma means the Buddha's teaching. Dhamma means whatever is true. Dhamma means whatever is happening in the present moment. It has a lot of different meanings. Sankhara is a bigger word than that. And sankhara means basically everything that's on the physical plane. Okay? So, because of ignorance, sankhara arises. Go ahead. Okay. Because of sankhara, consciousness arises. Because consciousness arises, mind and body arise. Because mind and body arise, the six sense doors arise. When the six sense doors arise, there's contact. When there's contact, feeling arises. What is feeling? Pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. It's not good feeling, bad feeling. It's just a pleasant feeling, an unpleasant feeling, a neutral feeling. Because feeling arises, craving arises, right on its heel. Now this is where your mind says, I like this. I don't like that. This is where the false idea of a self occurs. It's the I like mine, I like it, I don't like it. And this is where your mind starts to get tight. And it's the subtle tightness that I was talking about. When you start letting go of that tightness in your mind, and you feel your mind open up and expand, and then there's no more thoughts right after that, the reason that occurs is because you've let go of this very subtle belief in a permanent self. You start seeing everything more as process instead of taking it personally. Now, right after craving is when clinging arises. And clinging is thinking about all the reasons that you like this or that you don't like it. It's thoughts. And that clinging is affected by craving. Okay? So there's this tightness, this grabbing on. There's this idea that these things are yours. And because of that, being arises. And this means your habitual tendency towards those kind of thoughts and those kind of feelings. And because you have this habitual tendency, there's always a birth. There's always the start. And then there's the death. And sorrow, lamentation, and on. Pain, death, old age, sickness, all of these things. And because of that, ignorance arises again. Now this is how everything works. And it's incredibly complicated and hard to understand. But when you meditate in the right way, and you get to a certain place in your meditation, and it's very deep, where there is a spot that's called the cessation of perception and feeling. Perception and feeling don't arise anymore. It's just like somebody turned off the light. When the perception and feeling arise again, you will see dependent origination if your mindfulness is good enough. And you'll see it forwards and you'll see it backwards. This is not Nibbana yet. But the understanding you get in being able to see dependent origination purifies your mind so much that Nibbana occurs right after that. What's Nibbana? Unconditioned. It's the state beyond anything else. That's such a slippery term, I don't like to use it. It's Nibbana. Yeah. Perfect. Now, in order for you to see these 12 links of dependent origination, there are 7 factors of enlightenment. And the seven factors of enlightenment have to be in perfect balance. The first factor is mindfulness. The next one is investigation of experience. The next one is energy. The next one is joy. The next one is tranquility. The next one is stillness and steadiness of mind. A lot of people call that concentration, but I don't. And the last one is equanimity. Now, when all of these factors are in perfect balance, you'll see dependent origination. You see everything with complete balance. And there's no wobbling of the mind at all now. It's just like that. Something to work for. And I have to tell you, in Thailand, in Burma, in Sri Lanka, the monks will actually go around and tell you, there's no sense in even trying. You can't do it in this lifetime. I'm here to tell you that that's a lie. You can attain that in this lifetime. You can. You have to be serious. You have to do a lot of meditation. You have to be mindful of your daily activities, watching your mind, how it grabs onto things and relax and let go. When you start seeing everything as process, your meditation will take off, just zoom. When you get Venerable Sariputta and Venerable Moggallana, they were the first and second chief disciples of the Buddha. They both experienced Nibbana in the same way. They went through the first four jhanas, and then they went into the immaterial realm, infinite space, infinite consciousness, nothingness, neither perception nor non-perception. And then they experienced that cessation of perception and feeling, and seeing dependent origination, and then they became arahats. Now, the Venerable Sariputta was second to the Buddha in wisdom. Didn't matter what kind of meditation you were practicing, you'd come to him and ask a question, he had the answer. He knew the meditation extremely well. Venerable Moggallana was second to the Buddha in psychic ability, flying in the air, reading people's minds, diving in the earth. He could do just about anything he wanted to, as long as he directed his mind. Now, what's the difference between these two beings? Venerable Sariputta was very intellectual. He was not very sensitive to feelings. His mind went towards analyzing. Moggallana was very sensitive to feelings. Not such strong in the intellect, not like Sariputta. He still had good intellect. So Sariputta was the first chief disciple, and Moggallana was the second chief disciple. Now, a lot of people, they come to me and they say, I want to do the meditation so I can get psychic abilities. And it's true. There are a lot of people come and they tell me that. And that's fine. But it's not my choice. I can teach it. But if you're not really sensitive to feeling, you're not going to be able to experience it. If your mind has that tend, that bend more towards the intellect, then your mind is going to develop wisdom. And you're not going to be able to have that. So it's not my choice whether you experience psychic abilities or not. It's up to you. Can people still experience psychic powers right now? Yes. How long will it take you to do that? Depends on you. How serious are you with the practice? You want to come and do a retreat? Say we have a 2-week or a 1-month retreat. You come and do the 2-week or 1-month retreat. You keep your practice going. You start doing your mental development while you're doing your daily activities and see how you cause your own pain and start letting go of that. How fast is your progress? It's up to you. It doesn't take so long. It really doesn't. Not if you're serious. To get into jhana, if you're really serious and you do the practice every day, at least, let's say, an hour once a day, or if you can do more, that's better. And you do a retreat or two, of a week, something like that, maybe 6 weeks. Doesn't take so long. And once you get into jhana, that's the first major step. That's the starting block. Your progress after that is reasonably fast, up to the fourth jhana. When you get to the fourth jhana, then that's the next major step. And you have to keep developing that equanimity even as you go higher and higher. But this is not just equanimity while you're sitting. This is equanimity all the time. This is one of the major differences with the way people are practicing Vipassana right now and what I teach. Because people that practice Vipassana, they have the tendency to, what was it you said today, as soon as their bottom hits the pillow, they're meditating. But when they get up, they're not. And they're practicing a kind of one-pointed concentration, where you get to certain levels of concentration and the force of the concentration starts pushing the hindrances down. Doesn't allow them to come up. It's not that you do it on purpose, it's just that that's the force of the concentration. Then when they get up, guess who loses it as soon as they get up and start walking around and haven't got that concentration anymore? And guess who gets attacked? Even stronger, because you've been pushing it down, making it stronger by that resistance of the concentration. The way that I'm teaching, you never are able to suppress. If you do, you're going to have so much pain that you'll let it go eventually. You don't suppress, you don't push down anything for any reason. It's not one-pointed concentration. One-pointed concentration takes your mind and you contract it a little bit and pull back, and then you focus. What I'm teaching you is the opposite. Open up and relax continually. Now what happens when you first start doing this? You first start meditating, your mind is going to flip-flop. The hardest part about meditation is when you first start. Your mind jumps all over every place. You get lost for 2 or 3, 5 minutes and don't even know that you're meditating. But as soon as you notice, then you let it go and relax and come back. That's fine. No problem. As you become more calm, your mind doesn't go quite as far, quite as fast, and you're able to stay on your meditation for a longer period of time. 1 minute, minute and a half, 2 minutes. And it's real neat because that's when you're peaceful and calm. And when you see that happening, you start to gain more confidence. And as you go deeper into meditation, the distractions become less and less, and your mind stays on your object of meditation for longer until you get into the jhana. Now, once you get into the jhana, your mind is doing this instead of this. And as you go deeper in the jhana, the movement becomes less and less until you get to the fourth jhana, where it just starts to be a vibration. And then you go into the deeper jhanas, into the arupa jhanas, the immaterial realms, and the vibration becomes faster and slower and slower and slower and slower until it's barely even moving. And then the cessation of perception and feeling, it stops. And then the wisdom is developed by your seeing dependent origination and experiencing nibbana. That's what jhana means. Jhana means a meditation stage or level. And you don't have to know what jhana you're in. As a matter of fact, I never tell anybody what jhana they're in. It doesn't matter. It's useful for me to know what jhana you're in, but I can recognize what jhana you're in, just so I know how to talk with you. That's why it's the Buddha, he continually talks about jhana over and over and over and over and over again. But it's just to help the teachers to be able to recognize and say, okay, now you're experiencing this, how do you see that? Now, are you seeing that right? Things like that. So dependent origination is the most wonderful thing that the Buddha discovered. Now you can say, well, but how about the Four Noble Truths? The Buddha discovered that. Dependent origination is the description of the Four Noble Truths. And this is the second and third noble truth. It's the seeing of the cause and letting go of it. So this is a detailed account of the four noble truths. Skill in knowing what are causes and what are not. What are causes and what are not. I'm not sure I know what that means. And the Pali doesn't explain it well enough. I'd need to have the full sutta so that I could see what it says before and after here. But I've just been talking about what the causes are. I mean, that's what dependent origination is. Well, that's why I say I don't know what this means, because I need more than what they're talking about right here in the Pali. I need to find out the other words around it. So we'll skip that one and go to straightforwardness and modesty. What does straightforwardness mean? It means honest. Yeah. And what does modest mean? Lack of pride. Not bragging. See, the thing with pride, it's a very low mental state. And it causes your mind to be tight. And it causes you to identify with all of the things as they arise. Okay? It causes your mind to be like this. So you can be proud of something that you're doing, but that pride is the very thing that's going to cause you problems. When you're modest, it's not you doing it. It's just, look at that. Isn't that wonderful? Now, you might have worked a long time to get to that result, but it doesn't matter. It's not your result. It's just there. And being straightforward means being able to recognize that. Being able to recognize that mind that tends towards, look at what a good job I did, to, wow, isn't that wonderful? And it doesn't matter whether you did it or not. This is where true art occurs, when there's modesty. Mozart and Beethoven both, they were as much in awe of the things that they put down on paper as everybody else was. And they couldn't believe it. They were just hearing this music and then writing it down as fast as they could. And they didn't have any pride in what they were doing. When you don't have pride in what you're doing, when you're very modest, that means you're going to progress faster. These results will happen more and more quickly. Modesty doesn't have a self. It just happens. But it's right after that. That I'm talking about. Right. It just happens, and it happens great. And if you start taking the credit for that, then you're getting lost in negative mental states because you're identifying with it. The more modest you become, the more those results will occur. Practice makes perfect. Sometimes. Sometimes it can. But even then, I mean, I'm not talking about thinking about and planning, but sometimes mind is there saying, well, not quite, almost, yeah, that's it. But it's not my mind, it's just observation. Well, again, that you can say it just happens, but sometimes there are thoughts. Sometimes. And it's not my thoughts, it's just observation thoughts. Now, the same thing happens with meditation. Sometimes there is going to be thought while you're meditating, but it's just what's happening right now in the present moment. Oh, there's some joy. Oh, there's real strong tranquility, peace. And there's not any more verbalization after that. It's not, oh, I wish it would stay, because as soon as you have that, it's lost. It's just observation thought of the present moment. That's all. And that happens a fair amount, actually, in meditation. Or it can. Even though I called meditation silent observation of the present moment, doesn't mean that it's completely devoid of verbalization. There's still some. All the way up to neither perception nor non-perception. When you get to that stage, then there is none. But up to the realm of nothingness, there's still the observation thoughts. Well, it's almost 10 o'clock, and my throat is starting to give out a little bit. So we'll stop and start again on 14. What time tomorrow? It's up to you.